son's life. You know, I'm not even sure he has acknowledged this, but the legend that he gave his son a joint to smoke when he was 6 years old, and that this began moving him in a direction that perhaps has turned out not to be a very good direction for him. But whatever else is going to... And incidentally, Downey Sr. has acknowledged that he has been a heroin user all of his adult life. And his explanation is that you can use heroin as long as you have a regular supply and don't have to go out and beat people over the head and steal to maintain. Now, that...
Well, that sounds a little bit privileged.
Yes,
in
it
terms
is.
Of drug
well,
use.
That's exactly what it is. It is privileged. And it is, again, part of the whole machinery, I think, that we're talking about that begins to occur in the arts. Some of the gears chew people up, and some of the gears keep the machine moving. But Downey, I think, has always to be mentioned when we talk about American film artists. Scorsese, obviously. Another favorite film of mine. Let's see how you respond to this one. Eight Men Out. John Sayles.
That one I haven't seen.
Okay, Eight Men Out.
That's the baseball.
That's the story of the scandal in baseball. In 1919, the Chicago White Sox, who considered the best team maybe in history, ended up losing the World Series to the Cincinnati Reds, who were considered very fortunate even to have won the National League pennant. And it was later discovered that bribery had taken place. It began, incidentally, with a pitcher, Ed Chicot, who had been promised... This is fact, actually. I mean, Sayles didn't make any of this up. I mention him again because I think Sayles, with Brother from Another Planet, Lone Star, mm-hmm. More recently, absolutely superb filmmaker.
Well, he's also an example, I think, of someone who's managed to work it outside of that system. I mean, and he is also the man who made Alligator.
Yes, and let's remember that he
so he knows how to
manipulate, right?
And as you know, in Alligator, this is the alligator in the sewer, 30
feet long. Right.
Although it is never said on screen, as a scene where the detective is describing the MO of the alligator living in the sewers, and he has the name of the first victim written up behind him. The name is Ed Norton.
Ah, okay. Very yes, yeah, so we got Ed Norton circulating through American mythology.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In this rather remarkable American story in many ways, Ed Chicot was the best pitcher probably in the American League at the time. And Charles Comiskey, who was the president and CEO of the White Sox at the time, after whom the ballpark was named, said to Comiskey near the end of this brilliant season the White Sox had, if you win 30 games this year, I'll give you a $5,000 bonus. Well, $5,000 in 1919 was an enormous amount of money. It was more than most of the players made for the season. And Chicot, when he reached 29, began to celebrate. He said, you know, because he had another either three or four starts remaining in the season. And Comiskey sent word to the manager of the White Sox not to give him another start. Okay.
Because he didn't want to lose the money.
Well, he didn't want to give up the $5,000. So at 29, Chicot's season had to come to an end, and he never had an opportunity to win the 30th game. Well, gamblers discovering this, because it was quite obvious that he had three or four more starts possibly, he wasn't getting, something was going on, and they figured Chicot and some of the other players were ripe for a bribery attempt. Well, many of them were. It is said that Chicot never bit. It is also said that Shoeless Joe Jackson,
say it ain't so.
Yeah. Incidentally, you know, that is supposedly was the dream of a reporter, that there actually wasn't
those fine American moments never happen.
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, as you've mentioned, the story was that when they came out of the courthouse, the little toe-headed kid ran up and said, "Say it ain't so, Joe." Well, the larger issue in all of that was that what circulated in Chicago, and there is an allegation, I've never actually seen this in print, that the whole thing was apparently set up by Arnold Rothstein, the New York gangster gambler, whose money was used to bribe the players who did bite. And when the whole thing was discovered, and when the Chicago White Sox fell in disgrace in what was called the Black Sox scandal, and the players were all spared a jail sentence, but were then banned from baseball, including Shoeless Joe Jackson, at a point when his career probably had a number of years left in it. But, and again, I have not seen this in print, but it is alleged that in one of the Chicago papers, it was said about this entire scandal, again, citing Arnold Rothstein, only a Jew would do something like this to the great American game of baseball.
Now, was that in print, or is this something that's circulated?
It is alleged to have been in print in a Chicago newspaper. Let me again be clear. Full disclosure, I have never seen it in print. It's been cited to me by a number of journalists who claim that, in fact, it did appear. Now, I can imagine that something like that would appear in the early editions of a paper and never be seen again. But apparently this was not an uncommon attitude expressed in Chicago at that time.
Well, of course, because our great baseball players could never go bad on their own.
No,
you know, they had to be
not
coaxed, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk with you about an interview you recently had, because I know...
Speaking of Americana.
Yes. Okay.
This is WBAI, right?
WBAI 99.5 FM from the city, and we always advise people, don't ask what city. The city ought to be enough. You recently had an interview with Colson Whitehead,
mm-hmm,
on the new book, John Henry Days. And I had an opportunity to talk with Colson Whitehead when his first novel was published, that being The Intuitionist. Not only did I find him a very engaging person to speak with, but I found The Intuitionist one of the more compelling pieces of fiction I've read in some time. I was reminded first of a writer whose work has always impressed me, and that is Thomas Pynchon, particularly Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49, which I think is, again, one of the great unsung heroes American novel champions, right? But I haven't had an opportunity to read John Henry Days yet. I would, though, like to talk with you about the interview you did with Whitehead and how you felt about his current place in American letters.
Well, really, it's not my business to determine what his place is.
Okay.
You know,
an opinion will do.
Yeah. Well, I thought the book was brilliant. I just thought it was flat out brilliant, and his strategies, the way he was approaching this story, and to put it very, very simply, I mean, the bones of the story are based around real life events, and mm-hmm, this is the postage stamp,
yes,
that carried John Henry's image, and it was part of a series of postage stamps that carried Pecos Bill and Paul Bunyan and one other sort of folkloric figure. And the originally they were going to do the unveiling in Pittsburgh, and then Talcott, West Virginia, claimed to have been the place where the tunnel was, where John Henry beat the steam drill and dropped dead. So the present story is based in Talcott, West Virginia, centering around a journalist, African-American young journalist who's based in New York, who is a junkie, who is trying to set his own record for dissipating himself on free crap. And so he has gone down there to just eat for free and try to write some kind of a blurb about this postage stamp. But what Colson Whitehead does is he delves into this whole question that so many writers are dealing with right now, which is, is there such a thing as a singular truth? And he begins the book pulling from, and this came out in the interview because I wasn't sure if these were actual letters that had been sent to the Chicago Defender or if he was manufacturing them. He said it was a mix of both. These were people from all over the South writing to the Chicago Defender saying, yes, I knew John Henry, and he was X, Y, and Z. And the portraits that emerge in just the letters that he opens this book with, he was an upright man, loved his wife. He was a womanizer. He was a white man. He was X, he was Y, he was Z. Every different take under the sun emerges for this seminal, this figure. And we never really know if he's real or if he is not real. And, you know, Coulson did say that one of the things he was shooting for is he didn't want to lose ambiguity at any stage of the story, even up to the very end. He does not give you what you expect. He doesn't tell you even what happened. You know that something terrible happened, but he's not going to give it to you. And I found that really exciting.
Well, in The Intuitionist, which is in many senses much more a fictional design. I mean, it doesn't draw on a specifically notable heroic figure as someone whose name would be recognizable. Lila Mae Watson is an elevator inspector in an unnamed city, and elevator inspection has moved to the point where there are two essential processes at work, and that is the by the book, you know, step 1, 2, 3, and 4, right down the line, you do everything according to protocol. Lila Mae Watson is, as the title suggests, an intuitionist who feels that when she walks into an elevator, everything in her body responds to that space and informs her whether or not this elevator is functioning properly. Well, of course, in the larger scheme of things, that is, a black female working in a male and white dominated profession, you can only begin in the early pages of this piece to imagine what she is going to encounter. But what I found in The Intuitionist was Colson Whitehead operates out of something that I think quite unfortunately is missing from a great many artists. And that is the trust in his imagination. He feels completely at home imagining things, making things up and putting them down on paper. Even I would suggest, and I haven't had an opportunity to read yet, although we did get it just last week, actually. I haven't had an opportunity yet to read John Henry Day's, but I have to imagine that that is at work as well. This trust in the artistic, the creative, the aesthetic, if you will, imagination, which is, I think, being lost in a lot of instances with writers.
Well, I think you can also see that. I've read John Henry Day's and blew through it, as I often have to. The Intuitionist has been sitting on my table for a year and a half now. I think if the prose style in the first book is anything like the Colson Whitehead's prose style in the second, that he also trusts himself to break some rules.
Yes.
And to write in a very, I don't know what the proper word is, verdant, you know, it's very rich, sensitive
imagery,
prose.
Yeah,
in places it reminded me of Annie Prue, who I've spent a good deal of time with, who also breaks those rules. And for some readers, she's purple. She's over the top. And Colson Whitehead doesn't go quite over the top in the way that Prue does, but this is someone who they couldn't beat it out of him. They couldn't beat the sense of richness out of his language. And so often writing programs are trying to like cut and cut and cut and cut. It's a good thing because often new writers overwrite stuff.
Well, you know, with Colson Whitehead too, one of the things, and I'm glad you brought up the point of breaking rules. Because a lot of his sentences wouldn't pass muster in a creative writing course. You know, sentences without verbs, sentences that seem to lapse on which pronoun is being said. And that kind of, again, the trust in the imagination is the sentence fragment is going to make sense to the reader, even as it has made sense to him. Well, you have to have a great deal of trust in your ability to communicate something in order to write that way. And I think among many of the younger writers, that effort, people attempt to do that, not always especially successfully, and I think Whitehead is an example of someone who does it quite well.
Yeah, in fact, he used the word trust. Mm-hmm. Because one of the real questions for me is that the figure of John Henry is an unresolved figure, a fictional figure. Did he or didn't he exist?
Yeah.
Well, Colson Whitehead at one point invents his own,
mm-hmm.
and he sort of commits to the reality of who John Henry was.
Mm.
And for me, looking at it from a distance, I hope, folks, this doesn't sound too arcane, but as a narrative strategy, you're putting everything on the line. If you've created this sort of fog of unreality around a person who may or may not be, and then you decide, yes, he does.
Mm.
And the word he used was that he trusted his material to walk him through that process and to put all of the pieces together. This is a book with, I think, 200 distinct characters in it, which is also a matter of trust, being able to trust your readers, especially. And this is, you know, we were talking before we started rolling tape about reading and,
mm-hmm.
you know, the state of reading in the United States. And it's, I think, very, very important. It wasn't him who said it. It was a writer from Tasmania, Richard Flanagan, who wrote a book called Death of a River Guide, who said it more clearly than anyone. We were talking about my impression of his book, and he said, well, and I was wrong. I got something wrong. Only I didn't. The observation he made is that reading is a more creative act than writing.
Hmm.
And I think that the best writers allow that to happen. And any reader can do that. I mean, it's a much more active event in your life than we're led to believe by teachers and everyone else.
I had a teacher, I was a sophomore in college at this time, and beginning to think about writing. And I submitted a piece one day. Our instructor read a portion of it in class. And after, when he spoke to me, he said, you know, I can see you work very hard on this. You know, it's obvious that a great deal of work has gone into it. He said, well, let me suggest something to you, and that is that you learn to write by reading. That many people forget that. They labor and labor over the actual writing of something. And what they neglect, it becomes incredibly important for everybody who eventually wants to write, to be regarded as a writer, I guess. And that is, you've got to read. You have to know not only what has been said, but how it's been said before, and what sort of impact it has on you. And I think your point here is that it is not only a creative activity to read and to read regularly. I mean, I cannot recall a moment in my life, and I'm talking about my adult life, childhood, ever, when I didn't read something. You know, you just don't go through a day without reading something. And the fact is, it is, in my judgment, one of the more nourishing acts that human beings perform. And his point, I think, really meshes with yours, that this is a creative act, that when you are reading, you're not simply receiving information. A lot more than that is going on. What I'm concerned about with many younger kids I've spoken to recently is that they don't distinguish between information and knowledge. They don't see that information has to be leavened, I suppose, or cured with analysis, with critical analysis in order to
right.
be turned into knowledge.
Don't you think that's part of a culture that just loads information on you
well,
by the bucket?
They warehouse information, and people say, well, look out in my backyard. You see that big building filled with information? I said, well, what does it do for you? I spoke to a group of kids at City College, each one of whom, it seemed, had a laptop, buzzing away. And I said, look, you know, information, obviously in the modern era, is very important. But where do you go with it? What happens to it eventually? And I think, again, I would use the term nourish, because, in fact, I was fortunate to come along in a family where the only time people weren't talking in my house was because they were reading. Those are the two things. You talk and you read. And I think so many people miss... Matthew, I want to, before I get carried away with my own rhetoric, I want to ask you, who else is impressing you among the writers you're encountering right now?
Well, what's always exciting is that, I'm in a very privileged position, because it's taken a few years, but I now have relationships with some of these people that I've seen them over the course of years and looked at their work. I mean, I try not to recommend unless I'm really wowed by something and I've really had the chance to read it. I always think that people have various forms of taste. The last book before John Henry Days that I sort of broke my own rules and went to the air and said I recommend it was this book by Manuel Suri. His last name is S-U-R. And it's called The Death of Vishnu. And it is a story set in a tenement house in Bombay. And it's the arc of the story is essentially this. This is a building of maybe five or six stories, six, seven apartments. And as happens in extremely poor circumstances, there is a fellow who lives on the landing between the first and second floor. He dies. And part of the sort of the Hindu ascension mythology is the stages of leaving your body and ascending. And as this spirit moves, we see the various people in this house. So we see a widower, we see a Hindu family, we see a Muslim family, we see social pretension, we see a Bollywood script being acted out between a Hindu girl and a Muslim boy, all in this building. And it's extremely funny and very robust and really quite beautiful. The author is a mathematician. Manuel, and he was a great character. What if I could just take a second, because sure. This is there are a lot of books that I could lay out and for summer reading, but what we did this last year. I think that it may not be too pretentious at this point to give the audience an assignment, which is to read. And what I've noticed is that there are people who will read fiction but don't want to read nonfiction because nonfiction is too dry. And there are people who will read nonfiction but won't read fiction because it's, quote, not true. So my assignment, if I had one, is to read three books between now and Labor Day. Two of them, well, we'll do it this way. If you read Spanish, you can do it in Spanish, but the book has to be in the original language, no translations, to read a work of contemporary fiction, something published in the last 5 years.
Okay.
Not genre fiction, because genre fiction tends to be about formula and manipulation. But it doesn't have to be. It can be pop literature, no problem. Then to read a work of nonfiction, ideally history, biography, essays, not a self-help book, and not a pop biography, but something that is essentially about what is true and what is documented. And you're reading the fiction to find the truth in the fiction. You're reading the nonfiction to find the invention in the nonfiction. So these two books can actually speak to each other. And then the third one is to read a book that you loved passionately many years ago. And it could be anything. It could be a work of poetry. It could even be self-help. Whatever it is. But some book that really marked you and impressed you and that had life-changing ability, something you loved, Years ago, let me
see if I can put a little flesh on those. Last phrase for this.
The goal there is that what you're actually doing is you're engaging in autobiography.
Right.
Because you're finding, who was I that this book meant something to me?
Well, let me say this. One book that I would, within the framework that you've offered here, I would ask people to read a book called On Parole, which is so much a fiction piece that one forgets that at times it reads like a documentary. It's the story of a man who serves some 16 years in prison for a murder, in fact, that he did commit, and his attempt to readjust to life in a changing Japanese city when he comes out. And so much has changed. It's that point in Japanese history when perhaps more changes than in all the previous centuries.
Are we in the 50s?
No, later than that, actually. It's really not specified so specifically, but it's modern time. And it's a time that I think the author, Akira Yoshimura, wants to say, so much has changed in Japan during this period that no other period in the nation's history can be cited for that much change occurring in that relatively short period of time. The other book I would recommend that is, in effect, again, a documentary, is a book called On the Res by Ian Frazier. And it's an attempt by a self-professed WASP to enter the culture of Native people in America. And it is just a brilliant piece. The other one, which is fiction, of I think a very high order is John Edgar Wideman's The Cattle Killer.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that, because that I don't know if Wideman has ever gotten enough support or recognition for his fiction work, but that is, to me, that is, you know, we're right now.
I am no earthling. I drink moonshine on Mars and mistake meteors for stars because I can't hold my liquor. But I can hold my breath and ascend like wind to the black hole and play galaxophones on the fire escapes of your soul. Blowing tunes through lunar wombs, impregnating stars, giving birth to suns that darken the skins that skin our drums. And we be beating infinity over sacred hums. Spinning funk like myrrh until Jesus comes. And Jesus comes every time we drum. And the moon drips blood and eclipses the sun. And out of darkness comes the... And out of darkness comes the... And out of darkness comes the...
The Underground Railroad. Hip-hop music and culture. Every Saturday night from midnight to 2 a.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Morning Dew, a program exploring the music of Grateful Dead and related configurations, presents an original atmosphere of sound every week, featuring live Dead, plus an extreme diversification in music from blues, funk, hip-hop, classical, folk, and indigenous grooves. Commercially free in New York City and the surrounding universe.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news. Only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Coming up next, from lockdown, Radio Free Aaron.
Welcome to Radio Free Aaron. It's getting very difficult to get people over there in Ireland. Everybody's on holidays, but the one people that are not on holidays are the Loyalist death squads. Gunfire has erupted today in parts of North Belfast, and there's been rioting going on all week, and yet there's no marches going on. Everybody would have you believe that the only time there's rioting or people being shot is that when there's orange marches going through. We'll be calling over to Belfast, the north part of Belfast, and speaking with Joe Lagan of Republican Sinn Féin, who is in the area, and he'll give us the latest update. Also, we have in studio Pauline Campbell. She's with the Gavahi Road Residents Association, and she'll be telling us what's going on in that area when there is no marching and when they don't have the big steel cages going up around the Gavahi Road area to protect them from the orange culture that wants to come by their doorsteps. And we have Nolik Stationery today, and he'll be telling us about the latest on the 1998 treaty that was signed back then, and he'll give us an update on that. I think we'll do a few announcements right now. Sandy.
Okay, our friend George Harrison, the most unrepentant Fenian of them all, has sent us a statement, a tribute to James Connolly, what I believe James Connolly would have devoted his life to had he survived the 1916 uprising against British imperialism. A workers' republic with the working people of Ireland in control of Ireland and all its resources. Reaching outside Ireland, the working people of all the planet in total control of all the wealth it contains. Be used the interests of all the people to improve their standard of life and not that of just a few profiteers. A workers' world with the workers, regardless of race, color, gender, or creed, in complete control. Nature furnishes its wealth to all people in common. God beneficently has created all things, that their enjoyment be common to all living beings, and that the earth become the common property of all. Only unjust usurpation has created the right of private property. St. Ambrose, signed George Harrison, a follower of Connolly, and only George would dredge up from somewhere a socialist saint.
Okay, coming up tomorrow, a day to celebrate Bernard White, program director in exile from WBAI, Sunday, July 29th, 2 to 9 p.m. at Pier 63, that's 23rd Street and the Hudson River, featuring Odetta, Sam Archer, Heritage OP, DJ Andre D, and there'll be entertainment, prizes, dancing. So tomorrow, come out and celebrate Bernard White at the pier.
All right, it might be a great day outside, but it's not so great up here at WBAI. And it's hard for me to talk about the Bush administration banning Irish Republicans from this country, but they are allowed to be on WBAI. But fellow producers here are not. During the week, a great friend of Radio Free Erin and the Irish Republican community and myself, Robert Knight, was euphemistically called suspended from WBAI. Well, I called up the station during the week and I talked to Fred, and Fred told me that management had said that Robert Knight was suspended indefinitely. And then I talked to Robert Knight and he said indefinitely could mean the same thing that went on with Grandpa Al Lewis, who is still suspended indefinitely from here at WBAI, and it seems to be what's going on here at the station, and we can call it radio profiling here at Route 120 Wall Street. You would think the next thing they're going to charge Robert Knight with is TWB, Talking While Black. And I just want to say that Robert's been a personal friend of mine. I first met Robert back in 1980 when I was wrapped in a blanket out in front of the British Consulate protesting the blanket protest in a mock cell, highlighting, and this was before the hunger strike. And when Robert came around, he was very unusual as a journalist, as he knew what was going on. He didn't have to be explained what was going on in Ireland. As an African-American, he identified right away what was happening. And with his reports out of BAI, he was the news director. We'd all rush back, Bernie, if you remember, back to Clancy's to hear the reports coming in at 6:30 from Robert's reporting about the blanket protest. And then he also got to meet Kieran Nugent. I think you were responsible introducing Kieran Nugent. Kieran Nugent was the first blanket man back in 1976 when he went into a cell. He refused to wear a prison uniform. He said, "You'll have to nail that to my back." It's unfortunate that Kieran has died since, all the worse of the wear from drinking in the later years of his life. But Robert was there.
And 13 gunshot wounds.
Right. And Robert was there the day that Kieran Nugent was arrested downtown and had exclusive interviews from WBAI. And what we have to realize here at the station, when you ban someone like Grandpa Al Lewis, you're also banning the guests that they would have on. Because since Grandpa Al Lewis has been banned, you do not hear the voices of Omar Wally Clay. You do not hear the voices of Father Lawrence Lucas. And now with Robert Knight being banned, and I don't want to use the term suspended indefinitely. I mean, we use all these euphemisms. Robert Knight is not on these airs. And when Robert Knight's not on, what he was going to have on his show were the people from Tula, Texas, where half the adult male population have been arrested in drug sweeps. Those voices are not now being heard here at WBAI. Robert Knight, who when he was in Panama, was back almost 2 weeks, and we had the invasion of Panama. I don't want to draw a correlation between Robert and Panama and our government going down there. But when Manuel Noriega was in trouble, who did he call? He called up here to WBAI to talk to Robert Knight because he could trust him as a journalist to get out whether you agree with Manuel Noriega as an ex-CIA agent or you didn't. He knew that he could get his voice heard here. Robert Knight has won the Polk Award for Contragate. I mean, we could go on and do a whole show just on what's going on here at WBAI. I mean, Robert Knight, when he did the morning news, he didn't do rip and read. And then after reading a statement from the AP, have to say, well, that terrorism, that was in the AP wire. I don't really identify with that. Robert would rip and rewrite. And with his humor and the way he could turn a phrase, and it must be because he's a country boy from North Carolina. I mean, Robert could turn a phrase. He could stick the knife into you, and you wouldn't even know it. I mean, that's how good Robert was. And his sense of humor, you would tune in the morning, you'd have to listen to every word. I mean, during the Reagan years, that's when he was really shining. I mean, when he's talking about the West Coast White House and everything like that. But I can almost guarantee one thing. When this conflict is finally ended here at WBAI, Robert Knight will be back in these studios with his sense of humor, with his cutting-edge reporting about what's going on in Tula, Texas. And that is one thing. Robert Knight will not be kept off the airwaves for very long.
I just wanted to...
Yeah, just as John was saying, Robert was a man who knew his topic before he got into it. I spoke many times with him about the North. He was as well-versed as anybody who was working with us on the thing. We introduced him to many, many Republicans who came over here on visits, surveys, etc. Robert always had time to speak to these people, and these people really enjoyed speaking to him since the man knew what he was talking about and knew how to present it. In fact, Robert would go as far as to find out what was the music you played. You know, that was one of his big things, too. You know, what was that song you played and the whole thing.
But, Bernie, it was just like other reporters would come up and they would ask you, oh, it's about Catholics and Protestants. Oh, Ireland's about... And these would be maybe Irish-American reporters, whereas you cut to the chase with Robert. Robert knew exactly what was going on, and he got right to the meat of the story.
Yeah, but I mean, at the time of the hunger strike, I did not know Robert. I had never met him, and I have great respect for him, and I've met him a few times. Like, I wouldn't claim him as a personal friend. But when I was thinking back, I remembered, and we were coming up to the anniversary of the death of two hunger strikers, Kevin Lynch and Kieran Dougherty, who were among the last to die. What I remember as the hunger strike dragged painfully on to 10 men dying, that the main so-called mainstream media, the commercial media, lost interest. It wasn't news anymore that people were dying, and it wasn't news anymore that people were on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral or at the British Consulate. But Robert, as a news director, and he was the news director throughout the hunger strike, saw that BAI reported each one fully, competently. There was a reporter at every demonstration. And I remember, as I said, I did not know the man, calling up late at night, early in the morning, just before the news was to go on, saying there's a demonstration, there's a picket, something's happening. People don't die at convenient times for news. Robert was always there. Robert always covered the story. And I do appreciate the chance, perhaps belatedly, to say how appreciative we all were at the time.
Yeah, and we never did get to say that. You know, as the time goes on, you just take Robert for granted, but now that his voice has been suspended from the airwaves here, we just hope he can come back, and you'll get to meet him at Pier 23 or 63.
Pier 63.
Tomorrow,
23rd
I'm
Street.
Sure Robert will be down there. And we want to dedicate this. This is a CD we have here called Revolutionary Speeches. And Sandy, maybe you can set this up. This is called The Rebel. And listen to the words and just put Robert Knight in, substitute it for Rebel.
This is a poem written by Patrick Pierce, who is the leader of the 1916 uprising, together with James Connolly, who George Harrison was just referring to in his statement. And, of course, Patrick Pierce, after devoting his life to the struggle for Irish freedom and Irish culture, was, of course, executed by the British. And this is, in many ways, a statement of his life and his commitment.
The Rebel. I am come of the seed of the people that sorrow, that have no treasure but hope, no riches laid up but a memory of an ancient glory. My mother bore me in bondage my mother was born. I am of the blood of serfs, the children with whom I have played, the men and women with whom I have eaten, have had masters over them, have been under the lash of masters, and though gentle have served churls. The hands that have touched mine, the dear hands whose touches familiar to me have worn shameful manacles, have been bitten at the wrist by manacles, have grown hard with the manacles and the task work of strangers. I am flesh of these lowly. I am born of their bone. I that have never submitted, I that have a soul greater than the souls of my people's masters. I that have vision and prophecy and the gift of fiery speech. I that have spoken with God on the top of his holy hill. And because I am of the people, I understand the people. I am sorrowful with their sorrow. I am hungry with their desire. My heart has been heavy with the grief of mothers. My eyes have been wet with the tears of children. I have yearned with old, wistful men and laughed or cursed with young men. Their shame is my shame, and I have reddened for it. Reddened for that they have served, they who should be free. Reddened for that they have gone in want while others have been full. Reddened for that they have walked in fear of lawyers and of their jailers with their writs of summons and their handcuffs. Men mean and cruel. Oh, I could have borne stripes on my body rather than this shame of my people. And now I speak, being full of vision. I speak to my people, and I speak in my people's name to the masters of my people. I say to my people that they are holy, that they are august despite their chains, that they are greater than those that hold them, and stronger and purer, that they have but need of courage and to call on the name of their God. God the unforgetting, the dear God who loves the peoples for whom he died naked, suffering shame. And I say to my people's masters, beware. Beware of the thing that is coming. Beware of the risen people who shall take what ye would not give. Did ye think to conquer the people? Or that law is stronger than life and than men's desire to be free? We will try it out with you, ye that have harried and held, ye that have bullied and bribed, tyrants, hypocrites, liars. Renunciation.
And welcome back to Radio Free Erin, and that was a dedication to Robert Knight, who is unceremoniously, not only did he have the indignity of being handed an envelope here on Wednesday night to tell him that he was not on the air, but they didn't even give him a phone call there where he could have saved the $1.50 for the subway fare to come up to the radio station. And the $1.50 home. He could have stayed at home if they would have told him that he wasn't on that night. We're trying to get Nolik right now, but we'll go to our in-studio guest while Eliza tries to work a little bit of magic here with our technical system through the phones.
Yeah, we have with us in the studio Pauline Campbell, the Gravahi Road Residents Association. Pauline, thanks for coming up on a beautiful Saturday afternoon.
You're welcome.
You know, we hear about Portadown and the Gravahi Road basically once a year. You know, when, as John said, the Orangemen try to inflict their wonderful culture on you. But I thought we might talk about the ordinary, so-called, life in the Gavahi Road. For instance, you know, if I want to go into the Times Square, which would be the center of town here, you know, have a drink, go to a department store, I mean, I might worry about the prices, but I don't worry about my safety. Would that be true for you?
No, in Portadown, actually, when they were building the new shopping mall, which would be like slap bang in the middle of the town centre, they actually have an entrance at the Woodhouse Street entrance, which is like where the Catholics would go in, and they have an entrance on the main street where like the other denominations would go in. So that would give you some sort of idea the sort of circumstances that we live in. People would go to the High Street Mall, not sort of around July or whatever, because it's coming up to the marching season and because of the whole tension and thing in the town. Other than that, they would go because there's one of the stores which would be like a southern firm, so you know they would go and support that or whatever. They wouldn't really go to town as such unless you mean you have to go to get clothes. We don't have any clothes store. We have a new bank system, which is a 24-hour bank system, which means we don't have to go up the town to go to the bank anymore. People do have to go to town to access like medical centres in the other end of town. If the kids want to go to the pool, the pool's in the other end of town. The town hall, naturally, is in the middle of the town. So, you know.
But talking about the swimming pool, I mean, would you kids be safe going to and from the swimming pool?
Well, they would go like in large numbers, you know, and try and do it that way or whatever. I have a nephew now who would have went to, who would swim and would be very good at swimming, and he actually had went and done like a cross community thing, and because he had went and done cross community, then the fellas that he had been aware with, like in Scotland, it was nice. It's nice to go to Scotland, and it's nice to go to America, and it's nice to go to all these places and be all nice to each other. But then when you come home, it's not so nice. And because of him knowing these children and then being able to identify him or whatever, then he was attacked at the pool, so he never went back.
Pauline, the American and British media would have you believe you're living in these conditions because you will not let Orangemen with bowler hats walk 10 minutes down the Gavahi Road, that if that was allowed to happen, these wonderful malls would open up to you, there'd be no sectarian abuse, and you can go anywhere within that part of the United Kingdom, as they term it, but until you let the Orangemen come down there, you're going to have problems.
There was always these problems, before the Orange... I mean, Gavahi Road is not a new phenomenon. Gavahi Road has been going on, like, I'm 38. Gavahi Road hasn't just sprung up the last, like, 5 or 6 years, the way the British media would like it portrayed. That, like, these people, like, are troublemakers, and these people, like, have started this whole thing. Like, we're being blamed on the whole troubles in the North, because, like, we're not going to lie down and take it anymore. Because the terminology is, like, crappies lie down. And the crappies ain't lying down anymore. You know, and that's what's pissing them off.
You know, Pauline, that's the that leads to the next question that a lot of Americans say. My God, if things are so bad, why don't you just move and get out of there?
Why should we move? That's where we were born. I mean, we have as much right to be there as they have. And I mean, an answer to your thing about the British government and stuff. I mean, the British government actually offered us 15 million. At some stage, 15 million was floated at like a talks process. Like, my rights aren't for sale. Do you know, I have a right to live free from sectarian harassment under the Good Friday Agreement. I have a right to choose where I live. I have a right to go to work. I have a right to all these sort of things, and I'm not getting that on the ground. You know, so...
But, Pauline, you bring up such a great point here about a lot of people think they can buy their way out of conflict. And there is the most bizarre piece, an op-ed piece today, in today's New York Times, and it's by Richard Friedman. Now, you say, oh, Richard Friedman, he must be on the ground in the North. He knows what's going on. Richard Friedman is a professor of economics at Harvard, co-director of the Center for Economic Performance at London School of Economics, and the byline's out of London, because where else? If you're going to write about Ireland, you might as well write about it from London.
Yeah.
Now, here's his solution, and it is a novel solution, I have to admit. And he's sitting in these ivory towers, whether it's in London or up there in Cambridge at Harvard. And he said, the major deterrent making Northern Ireland's Good Friday peace agreement effective has been the unwillingness of the Irish Republican Army to decommission its weapon. Is there a way to make decommissioning more palatable to the IRA and more certain for the unionists who demand to relinquish the IRA's arms as part of the peace? There may be an economic solution. Pay for each weapon that the IRA and Protestant paramilitary groups turn over to authorities, giving the money not to the paramilitaries themselves, but to a special development fund to implement the peace agreement and to invest in the well-being of the people of Northern Ireland. Far from being a sign of defeat, this sort of decommissioning would be a way for the IRA and other armed groups to turn their weapons into resources that would benefit their communities. The money to buy the arms could come from three sources: the British government, which could finance the initiative in part from reduced spending in military forces in Northern Ireland, the Irish government, and the Irish abroad who want to see peace in the old country. As in any bargain where money is involved, the parties would have to bargain over the price of each decommissioned weapon. The Catholic and Protestant communities in Northern Ireland would have the same goal, to obtain a high price for the weapons, while the two governments and the overseas Irish communities would want to pay a lower price. Now, I'm not reading from the Onion magazine. This is today's New York Times. Now, we have to picture this. This is Monty Python. You got IRA guys in balaclavas walking in with M60s, surface-to-air missiles, and now we have, well, from my point of view, I'm Irish-American, so I got to be bargaining with the IRA guy. George Harrison sent it over. Now I got to bargain to get the friggin' weapon back from him.
Well, see, that's
cheaper price than what George paid for the weapon.
Yeah, but that's the other point, too. There'll be a certain segment from here in New York saying, we want the money since we sent it over.
Right, right.
Get their money back.
And but this is how bizarre. This is what when academics get involved with political crisis. Could you imagine the Palestinians now stating to the Palestinians, listen, we have your solution. Come up to the bargain table, bring in the weapons, and what we'll do is decide how much we're going to pay to buy the weapon back, and then we'll give you that money to put into your community. Nowhere in the article does it say, you know what, there is reduced military presence in the north of Ireland. You see that money we're saving? We're going to give it to the community, help them rebuild it. This lunatic from Harvard is stating, no, that surface-to-air missile, I know you bought that in Libya and it went for about, what, 10,000? What was the going rate, Bernie, for surface-to-air missile? Around 10,000. Well, I remember down in Florida when the guys were buying it, it was 10,000 a missile. So, I don't know if I don't know if the price is appreciated now over time or has it decreased in value. But, I mean, these are the bizarre theories. No one has come up with a theory. How about we abolish the border, the British give an intent to withdraw, and then we negotiate what we're going to do with the weapons that are on this island. But as they brought up to you, they thought they could buy their way out of the Gabahi Road conflict. Yeah. They offered you money and just said, listen, just let the Orangemen go by.
And, I mean, the money sort of come up in the conversation, and then somewhere along the line, like, someone sort of stuck this £15 million.
But Pauline, it just shows the money's there to help your community.
Yeah.
British government essentially is saying, listen, we have the money, but we need you to do this. If you don't do it, we're going to make you suffer. You're going to suffer sectarianism. You're not going to be able to go into Portadown, and you're not going to you're going to live on the debt threat. I mean, that is some way of bargaining, isn't it?
Yeah, but see, that's part of the whole problem, that the British government, I mean, have denied the community stuff that they should have had for so long. And that is part of the problem. You know, they can't put their hands up and say, look, wash their hands of it, that's nothing to do with us, because they are part of the problem.
Yeah, well, the problem that this gentleman from Harvard runs into, that most of the loyalists held weapons are legally held weapons.
Yeah.
So they would not have to, you know, bargain and sell these type of things. They're talking about these alleged weapons that the IRA has that came in from Libya and every other place, that they want them. Now, anybody who's been listening to this show for any length of time knows that most of this stuff probably doesn't exist, these IRA weapons and everything like this. Ed Maloney says they're only 50% of what they had, and the other stuff is in a bunker waiting concrete.
That's still a lot, 50% of all.
It's waiting concrete in bunkers. Whatever it is, it's really a good plan, John. We used it in Washington Heights here, and you know how Washington Heights is cleaned up.
Oh, yeah. The precincts were just pulled over with everyone running down with the 9mm.
Sure.
There were traffic jams up and down Broadway. And
I want money for you to take this. I'm going to shoot you, man.
Yeah.
So this was it. These plans, they look good on paper, especially the New York Times paper.
They also look good when you're in the pub, at the London, the LSE, please, not the London School, right? The LSE, the Faculty Lounge, right? That sounds very nice.
Okay, I'm going to read two stories. Yeah, go ahead.
Pauline, the other thing that surfaces periodically, usually from the Orange Order side, and what people may not realize over here, is that the Orange Order will not even sit down at the table with the residents and discuss this. And their line is, it's all the fault of this man, Brendan, this evil man, Brendan McKenna. He's been on this show a few times.
Uh-huh.
But if you just get rid of Brendan McKenna, everything would be fine, hunky-dory, and everything would work out wonderfully.
No, Brendan's just a red herring, because, I mean, they just don't want to even admit that Catholics even exist in Portadown, never mind sit down and talk with us. So Brendan is just a red herring. You know, that's a load of rubbish, because the thing about it is, they talk about, oh, we're not going to talk to him because he's like a terrorist and blah, 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 blah. You know, Brendan didn't kill anyone. Billy Wright killed loads of people. They talked to Billy Wright, you know, so, like, they can't have a rule for one and a rule for another. That's a load of rubbish. I mean,
the good news is that they can't talk to Billy Wright anymore.
No.
You're listening to Radio Free Aaron, and it's 2 o'clock here. I'm going to read two stories, I'm going to play a song, and then we come back. We'll be heading over to Belfast to speak with Joe Lagan of Republican Sinn Féin to talk about some of the rioting that went on this week and some of the loyalist death squads that were shooting into the nationalist areas. Now, if you ever wonder where our baby Bush You've heard about Papa Bush. We got Baby Bush in the White House. How he ever got that little sickly wave that he does when he goes over to Air Force One. This was in this week's Irish Independent. And this is Bush talking about how he looks forward to meeting the Queen. How much he's looking forward, for example, to meeting the Queen again. He met her at a private lunch at the White House when his father was president, and quote, "She was great. A wonderful sense of humor. My mother and I, we like to tease."